And she was crazy enough to say, well, okay, sure. Yeah. And so then we hung out till like 3 a.m. And then the next day we got together again and hung out till like 3 a.m. And then we had our hiking date. So we went hiking again. And I was like, oh, this chick is pretty awesome. And
there it is.
But then I was like, damn it. God, I'm moving to Los Angeles. I was already moving to Los Angeles. Like I knew I was because CESD had signed me.
Yeah.
And so, I told her that I was planning on it. And so then I guess I just expected like, well, we'll spend a few more months and just hanging out and having a good time. And then, cause she was teaching voice at a private girls school in Nashville. And then she was for like 12 girls, just one-on-one. And then she was also singing with the Nashville Opera. The Nashville Opera pays so pathetically bad, but so she was doing some chorus work for the Nashville Opera, and then she was also a section leader at a choir for a very old money Presbyterian congregation in Nashville. So she had all that kind of stuff going for her, and so I just assumed she was going to stay in Nashville, and so I was like, well, I'm going to be moving in December, and she's like, I'll go wherever you go. And I was like,
oh my gosh.
Fuck. You know, so it was very flattering and I loved her. And I still love her. Obviously I married her, but it was incredibly stressful. Cause that like throws the whole plan into whack. It's like, oh, I get it. God, you want me to trust you that this is all going to work out somehow. Now that that everything has gone totally backwards of the way I thought it was going to go. So we ended up getting married very, very quickly because we were long distance for like our entire engagement. Because I moved to Los Angeles in December of 2016. And then, but then she's in a really tough place and she's getting pretty depressed and despondent because she's like, well, I can't put down more roots here and get more entrenched in Nashville because she'd only been there for a couple of years after college. She has her master's at that point in vocal performance. And so she's in this weird limbo where she can't put down more roots or get more entrenched with companies in Nashville because she knows at some point she's moving to Los Angeles.
Right.
But I believe that living together prior to marriage is bad because to me it's like you're looking for an excuse to break up. Like you're telling the other person, hey, I love you and I think it's gonna work, but I want to test run just in case it doesn't. So I think that that's just asking for failure. So I wasn't gonna do that. If I felt strongly enough about her that I was gonna marry her, I was just gonna get married. And I know that flies in the face of our traditional the way that culture is gone now, but and it's not so much like, I think it's a sin, but I'm also definitely not one of those Christians that's like, sin keeps you from anything, because that's the whole reason Jesus died for us. And anyway, before going into my whole theology, she was in this really tough place. So I wanted to wait, like, ideally, like 2 years, you know, to make sure that I really want to spend the rest of my life with this person. But I could tell she was like really in a bad place and really struggling because like, what does she do? She can't move to LA because I said I didn't want to live with her. She can't stay in Nashville because she's not staying in Nashville. So I just went ahead and proposed like after we'd only been dating for like 7 months. And then we got married like 3 months later. Married really, really quickly. And that was an incredibly, incredibly difficult and extremely stressful and miserable time to try, because we put together a full ass marriage that was like expensive, and especially expensive because you don't have the time to try to find vendors that are cheap, and people schedule their marriages so far in advance that like, we pretty much just had to take what was available. And so spent way more money than I wanted to, even though the marriage was really, really nice, what little I remember of it. And so then she moved promptly. We went on honeymoon to Jamaica and it was really lovely. And then although we were sick like the whole time, but then when she moved to LA and then, so we were married on June 23rd. And I want to say our first date was like May 29th. Like it was like barely a year from first wow. date to marriage. But like when you know, you just know. And
yeah.
And even though it's kind of tragic because we really don't have a lot in common hobby wise, aside from obviously our voice, but that's both of our jobs. So like we don't, people are always like, oh, do you like sing together? And I'm like, No, actually never. No. Because it's not so much fun when like it's your job. You know, accountants that marry each other don't go home and do like spreadsheets together. So but we both from like children wise and religion wise and politics wise and family wise are both like just super duper in like complete agreement on every single point. So that is really, really lovely. But we're still trying to figure out some hobby things that we can like spend time together doing. Cause that just, it's hard. She doesn't like listening to music the way that I do. And like, she loves doing arts and crafty kind of things and cooking. And I'm not super into that. We both humor each other and we'll do things together.
Sure.
But it's, it has been tough to, like figuring out. We both are big gamers. So we play games a lot together, but so that's life.
I don't know how you feel about this, Michael, but it sounds like a very healthy marriage and relationship.
We communicate well, or at least we both want to and are both interested in putting forth the effort to communicate well. And we're both students of and always learning about like how to effectively communicate. So it has been very, very hard, very, very often, but we both really love each other and we both love Jesus and we both have a heart for the same issues. And so, and she's just so damn smart and talented. But it was also hard because Los Angeles was a huge sacrifice for her because she left all her vocal students, she left her job, her opera thing. And then unbeknownst to us, she's borderline allergic to the air in LA.
Like, oh no.
So she got there and was just immediately sick for like 3 or 4 straight months. And it was really, really hard. And because then like the plan was to come out there, get involved with the LA opera, do some auditions for local performing companies, blah, blah, blah. Well, she's sick for like 4 months. So she several auditions she was supposed to do that she should have easily been able to get hired for. Her voice was gone, so she couldn't. So then that just turned into a big spiral for her. And so we've kind of been there for each other because I was trying to be super supportive of her during that really dark time in her life where she's just miserable. And then when she decided that we both decided that the plan would be for her to go back to school and pursue her doctorate because then she can get a job in academia that is much more stable, get benefits. I'm blessed enough to have healthcare through the union for the last couple of years, but it's always a crapshoot depending on your bookings. And so having stable healthcare makes life way easier. So we started looking at Las Vegas and Austin and Phoenix and for doctoral programs, ended up moving to Las Vegas. And so that was kind of her staircase out of the depression was like, well, now I have a purpose. Now I have a job and I'm working on stuff and goals again. Whereas in LA, she was just kind of languishing. So we moved to Vegas and we're both just way happier than we were.
So good.
But then she was feeling better, then she was able to be there for me when I was just getting worse and worse and worse through that time. So now I'm starting to feel better and making progress again and starting to book again. Woo!
Nice.
And so that's great. Taking some coaching with Dave Walsh, who is great. And been doing that for a couple months and just trying to, and obviously medication helps tremendously now that I can like focus on my life and my work and not be just quite so overwhelmed. Cause I think that was the difference when it was just me and I'm single in my little condo and all I have to do all day is either video games or my job. There's nothing to be overwhelmed by. It's just focusing on the next goal, the next ladder rung. But then when you now have two dogs and you have a wife and you have a much larger house and a lot of other schedule conflicts and auditions and bills and all these other things that you're juggling, I would just stare at my inbox and like just be like panic attack. Like I can't, and my thoughts are going around my brain like a hurricane so fast you can't even grab one to try to do anything. So, you know, just very inefficient from a time standpoint, which then contributes to being overwhelmed because you're not getting anything done, blah, blah, blah. And so so the medication has helped that like slow down. And now if I got a new thing on my to-do list, I can just do it and not get so in my own head about it. It's everybody's dealing with something, you know, and
I'm so glad to hear that you're receiving help. Like my wife was recently diagnosed with depression and all these things. And it wasn't until she received proper medication and therapy sessions that one morning she woke up and said, wow, this is what it feels like to be normal.
Yeah. Well, honestly, I've had that thought repeatedly.
Wow.
Of like just looking like one day, the first day that I really, it kind of popped into my head of like, wow, is this what normal people feel like? I had a lot of times I will, you know, I get auditions sent. And for those of you listening that aren't with agencies, the turnaround is usually very rapid. Usually it's within 24 hours. Often it's within like 8 hours. And so, you know, say I've got 6 auditions that I know I need to do before 2 p.m. is usually around the due time that they need to get them in. Well, so I would just sit there like looking at them like, I don't want to go. I don't into the booth. I'm not going to book them anyway. I wish I didn't have any of these to do. But then I couldn't just delete them because then I'd feel bad. And so then if I did a couple and then I'd get a couple same day things come in, I would just be like, oh my God, I can't even function. Like I've managed to make a little dent in it and it just refilled, you know, like digging a hole in sand. And so, but then post medication, when I got on my Adderall, I could just sit down and like, okay, I'm just going to try to get these 6 done. And then I'd do like 3 of them. And one would come in and I'd be like, okay, I'll add that to the list. And then I'd do like another 3 and then another one would come in and be like, okay, well, I'll do these 2. And so then like by 4 p.m., I was like, wow, I did 11 auditions today. Yes. And I never want, even because it was a day that I had multiple same day things come in, but I never felt that just dread and that overwhelming like, oh my God, I can't. It just never happened. And so that was like a, wow, it's actually kind of working. And some attributes, like I still forget stuff. And I think a lot of things after 32 years of entrenched behaviors and coping mechanisms with how much of a sieve my brain was is still going to be a lot longer to deal with. But the fact that my brain isn't just constantly and that I can kind of sit down and just do stuff without the dread is a huge improvement. And so there've been a few times since then where like, I got a to-do list of things around the house and I'll just do it. And it's like, wow, this must be how normal people get stuff done. It's incredible. So it's been an interesting journey.
I have this funny analogy for a path of a voice actor as he or she or they progress in this journey. I honestly believe that the equipment upgrade that we go through from our whatever microphone and interface and space that we start out with into whatever we're using now kind of serve as a mile marker of our progress in this journey. What did you start out with and what are you using now?
Sure. Well, again, I'm probably going to be a bit of an outlier because like I have made no secret of, I started out at a much more privileged position than most. And so while I started very meager, I upgraded much more quickly than most would. I started out on, actually, is it still this one? No, I gave that one to my wife. A really, really really bad microphone for voiceover, the AKG D5, which is basically the AKG version of a Shure SM58, just a handheld dynamic stage microphone, basically, which is not good at capturing all the nuances of your voice and not great. So I did that. Oh God, it makes me cringe. I'm even more keenly aware of just how bad it was because I just so recently found that whole folder of all my auditions from that era. I was using the AKG D5 on a little stupid desk microphone stand in a completely untreated room next to my noisy ass computer. So there's fan noise, there's room echo. It's just, what the fuck was I thinking? I mean, it's pathetic. So I realized after I did, like, I don't know, 160 auditions on voices.com that I wasn't booking anything. And it was probably my audio. And so I decided to make audio a really big, my next big goal was to get my audio quality better. So for Christmas of 2012, I basically was like, I won't ask for anything else or anything next year. Like I all I want a Neumann TLM-103.
Yeah.
And my parents were like, that's really expensive. And I was like, if we can coalesce my birthday into this too, I want this microphone. It's what my coach at the time was using. If I can get that standardized pro level audio quality, then if I'm not booking, I can eliminate that variable. And I know that it is purely because my reads aren't competitive. Mm. And so in my opinion, the more variables you can eliminate in voiceover that could preclude you from a job, the better. So anyway, then they were like, that Christmas morning, I got my mic and I was so excited. Nice. And mom was like, so it was really expensive, but we thought about getting a different one, but figured you were probably asking for this one for a reason. So here it is. But I was just so super duper grateful. And again, just talk about privilege that I could have a family that could gift me a like $1,200 microphone is just ridiculous. So many, many people cannot go that route. So if I wasn't privileged, let's pretend I would have gotten a Rode NT1A because that's like $250 and it's still very competitive. For bang for the buck, it's really high up there. I've got a lot of pro friends that still use it. So I probably would have gotten something like an NT1A or maybe I would have just used some of that money that I got from my massive trading card collection and just splurged on it myself. But anyway, so I used the Neumann TLM-103 for a little while. And then probably 3 years in, and I was recording in a walk-in closet in my condo that was stuffed with my clothes and luggage. And any spare walls and ceiling that was available, I threw up some discount audio foam that I got because I was so in Nashville, if any of you are in Nashville, there's a meetup group called the Tennessee Voiceover Exchange that bafflingly is probably the best voiceover meetup group in the whole country. Oh. And they had some member benefits. It was like $40 a year to be a part of it. And one of their member benefits was you got access to Guitar Center Pro discounts. So, it was sweet, but only for the Nashville Guitar Center. But anyway, so I got a bunch of audio foam for like half off and slapped it all over the few walls that weren't already covered with clothing in my closet. And I worked out of that closet full time for like 4 years and it sounded pretty good. Quality wise, you know, my reads were still not super great, but so I used the TLM-103 for 3 years. And then I was seeing more and more and more people just crowing about how wonderful the Sennheiser 416 was. So I bought a 416 when it was on sale. I think they're normally $1,000. I got it for $799.
Nice.
And so then to this day, the 416 is still my big workhorse. I kept my 103 just as like a say I have it. And just in case somebody wanted it, I kept it for another like 3 years, but it was just mostly gathering dust in a drawer. So I finally sold it to a friend for like $800. And then like 4 months later, this stupid pandemic hits and everything goes remote. And suddenly every character client, every video game studio is asking for large diaphragm condenser microphones like a TLM-103.
So I was like,
I was like, well, I need to get a large diaphragm condenser mic. And now I'm at the point in my career where like, let's just get the gear that everybody knows that makes me look like I know what I'm doing. And so yeah. I also, around the time that I got the 416, I splurged on I was still using it with a Focusrite 2i2, which is, you know, running a really great mic through a pretty low tier interface is not a great idea. But I did it anyway until it literally, I used it till it broke. And so then I bought Avalon VT737. And so that's been a workhorse for a long time.
Yeah.
And really good. So I've had that for like 3 years now. And then upgraded from the Focusrite 2i2 to an RME Babyface Pro, which is so much better. The preamps in that are so great. It's it's a killer travel setup. And that's one of the other reasons I like the 416 is that it's just an incredible travel mic too. And done a number of auditions and jobs from hotel closets just because the 416 cuts out so much room noise and the Babyface Pro has such solid preamps. So right now my signal chain that I use for 98% of things is the 416 into the Avalon, into the Babyface, into Adobe Audition. And then about two months ago, I guess. I finally took the plunge and bought a U87.
There you go.
Off reverb.com. But it doesn't really play very well with my booth. I had to spend a lot of time with a couple different engineer techie friends of mine trying to EQ it for my space and move my bass traps around and stuff to get it to sound good. And I don't think it sounds as good as it should or that I want it to, but we pretty well ruled out that we don't think it's the microphone. It's just a very small booth and I'm a very not small person. but it's there and it's fine. And I've used it for sessions and the client was happy. So that's what matters. And now I get to say I have a U87 and it makes people think I know what I'm doing. So that's basically the.
Well, I think you can wake up out of that misguided frame. You know exactly what you're doing now. Goodness.
Yeah. Well, it's been a road back though. I mean, because my reads got especially for commercial corporate stuff, got real bad during the pandemic. And when I was just in a really bad place in my brain. Even friends that I have, like our friend August, I'd send him stuff to be like, look, I need some help getting this stuff back together. And he's like, man, this doesn't even sound like you. And so the stuff I was submitting was just very kind of mail it in, whatever, because I was just in such a bad place mentally. And so I've been trying to get back out of that. But it's not as easy to climb back to and get back on top of where you had been as you would think. And a lot of it is because you just do so much practicing. You feel like you know what all the archetypes are supposed to sound like. And so then you're like, oh, well, I know this is a healthcare spot. It should sound like a healthcare spot. So I'll do an impression of a healthcare spot, but an impression of a healthcare spot doesn't book a healthcare spot.
Correct.
So I was stuck in template mode, just putting like this frame around like, oh, this is what it should sound like. So I'll just mail that off. But it didn't sound like me and it wasn't authentic to the copy. So That's been my big focus and my big struggle that I've been working on the last few months is getting out of template mode and getting very intentional about connecting with the stories in the scripts and connecting with the emotion and the authenticity and trying to deliver stuff that's more me instead of me, what Michael Schwalbe thinks a healthcare spot would sound like. And so, but we're getting there. So
August is very good with that.
He is good. Well, and he's been a very close friend of mine for a number of years now. So he knows what I sound like. And so maybe more than anybody, he knows when I'm delivering something that is very clearly not me and or something that sounds like me trying to be something else in a bad way. And so actors that are listening, it's very important to have friends that know the authentic you and know not just your actor self, but like that you talk with about your normal life and that hear you normally talking about other things you're excited about. Because if your actual excited voice is usually nothing like the, well, now I'm excited about this commercial copy voice that you put on. And so it ends up being kind of like if you work retail, you know, you get your customer service voice that is totally not you. It's just what you think it should sound like. So yeah, cultivate relationships with people that know what you actually sound like that can give you some more authentic feedback if you can.
Let's talk about the real authentic you. I know for a fact that the real authentic you has a very vast and interesting collection of things in bottles.
I am an incorrigible collector and of not just things in bottles. Things in bottles and things not in bottles. I have rock collection, mineral collection. I have a book collection. I have a coin collection. I have that crazy trading card collection that I sold. I had to get rid of a lot of it when I got married and moved because just why do I still have all this stuff? But yeah, getting into alcohol and in not just like in an alcoholic sense, although I have dabbled in that in a couple times during my really bad periods, but
same.
But just for like the love of the flavors and the to me, it's one of the most evocative beverages that can really transport you to a different place, a time, a feeling that, especially under lockdown, is very important and valuable, and so. I started getting into, actually, I haven't been drinking that long. I was actually totally stone sober for 9-something years.
Because
I got arrested for weed in college and after my roommate ratted me out, Mark.
Bastard.
I only had an eighth, but it basically just reinforced to me that like, what am I doing? I don't need a substance to have a good time. I'm throwing my life away. I was hanging out with some really serious druggies and just bad overall. And so I got that kind of was my kick in the pants to get back into church and the spirit. And that's a whole nother, I could go on at length.
Another episode.
But yeah, it really is. There was some crazy God things that just really delivered me through that. But anyway, so I wasn't interested in partying and the drug scene anymore. And so I just didn't drink. I had like one, the last drink I had remembered having was a margarita at Chili's on my 21st birthday with the guitarist in my band before we went and saw Chick Corea at the Nashville Symphony Center. And it was an incredible day. And that was the last drink that I remembered having. I maybe had one or two more, but I wasn't into the partying thing. So I was sober for 9 years.
Wow.
Or maybe 8 years, I guess, if it was 21 to like 29. But then I met Courtney and I was like, you know, I want to have a glass of wine with my wife at dinner, or like I was on vacation with my family and I rarely get to see them because I live far away from them. And so, or definitely then a little less far now that I'm in Las Vegas, but I was like, you know, I want to have a beer with my brother. I want to have a beer with my dad. And so I started trying to teach myself to enjoy alcohol. And which was very difficult after 9 years of not drinking anything.
Yeah.
It tasted just horrible. I mean, bad. And but I had also, the last few years, really gotten motivated by the philosophy of, because I was a super picky eater as a child. I got really motivated by the philosophy of, it's better to like things than to not like things. And a lot of people that make whatever they don't like is like their personality trait. And that's just so uninteresting and boring. And so I first started like, I want a new source of caffeine in my life. I'm going to teach myself to like coffee. And everybody says it's an acquired taste. So I'm just going to drink it till I like it. And started out at a coffee shop. And I was like, all right, I hate coffee. Coffee person. Make me a coffee drink that a non-coffee drinker would like. And so they made me a Cubano espresso latte. And I was like, actually, this is pretty good. And so I just kept, you know, getting more and more serious about coffee until I really like coffee. And so I basically did the same thing with cocktails and different spirits and beer. Beer was the hardest. It was really hard to like beer. And I still like IPAs. Why do you want to drink something that just tastes bad? Like you're just, I'm sorry, you're just wrong. Like they're just bad. And I mean, like if there's a free one, like I'll drink it because whatever, free beer. But like, why would you want to drink an IPA when you could drink something that is also beer, but just tastes good? So I don't know. But I guess I'll keep trying. But but for like a month after I started drinking, every time I would have like a sip of beer, it still felt like I was doing something morally wrong. And I had to like remind myself that I never had a reason. Oh, that was another reason that I started drinking again was because I was preparing to move to LA and all the actors I was talking to would be like, yeah, man, hit me up. Let's grab a beer when we get out there.
Yeah, there you go.
And like, it's really uncomfortable to say, well, I actually don't drink when you're trying to meet people. And because then like at best they go, oh, well, that's really great. Good for you, man. I'm really sorry. No problem. Yeah. Let's just get together. But then it's uncomfortable, but it's worse. I had a couple people that were like, oh yeah, man, I totally get it. Like, man, back when I drank all the time, I was really allergic to it. I would break out in handcuffs. And that's Frank not me. Like, I never had a problem with it. I just didn't like it very much. And it was easier to say I don't drink than it was to say I don't like to drink much and I don't want to now. So, all these like alcoholics that had DUIs and bad would like start commiserating with me. And I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to drink because I don't want you to think that I'm like you. So, So that got me started. And of course, being a red-blooded American man that's 6'4", you got to drink whiskey. And so but also I liked the flavor profile of a lot of like the caramel and vanilla, and you get a lot of this warmth and kind of oaky notes from it that's just really nice. And so I started getting into that a little and like a nice old-fashioned that's not made with tons of muddled fruit when you're drinking a fucking fruit salad. Like you're wrong. But or like a Manhattan, you know, just classic cocktails like that was kind of where I started. And nice. Took me a while to get into gin. That was the last of the spirits that I kind of tried to make myself like. I still don't like vodka very much. It seems like you get all the negativity of like drinking alcohol with none of the benefits of flavor. And so I drink very, very little vodka, but I started collecting whiskey somewhat and getting really interested in the different distillation methods and the different additives and the way that the barrels were constructed and the different woods. And I visited the Jack Daniel's distillery a couple times and just really, really loved the tour. Even before I was drinking, I went on that tour and I was just fascinated by it. And when I moved to LA, because Jack Daniel's is solely made in Lynchburg, Tennessee, from the same, all Jack Daniel's is from the same cave water that comes out of the cave that I have visited. And so it was kind of like a little bit of taste of home where I could drink this and be like, this water flowed out of that cave that I was at and, you know, right by Nashville and kind of reminded me of that. But then Jack Daniel's isn't great. I like the single barrel Jack Daniel's a lot.
Oh,
and
yes.
I've got a couple bottles of that. And but the normal Jack, unless you're just putting it in Coca-Cola, doesn't do a whole lot. So got really into that, and Courtney had to really about the time I had like 14 or 15 bottles of different whiskeys. She was like, okay, you can get more if you finish one of the ones you have. I have other friends, like my friend Carson Beck is just a super duper whiskey and scotch head. And so yeah. I love getting together with him and tasting different things. And he was getting really into some very, very fancy scotches and that I got to try. And so I started trying some Japanese whiskeys and got a couple bottles of those. And I tried to get a little more into scotch. I'm not a big scotch fan. The really nice stuff is nice. The peated whiskeys and scotches are difficult for me to appreciate because it just tastes like bog water. It's just so musky and overpowering. But I can handle it a lot better now than I could then, really. Right. But I much prefer the less peaty whiskeys. But then about, gosh, when was it? It might have been when I kind of got out here. I started really getting interested over the course of the pandemic in tiki drinks. And so specifically because a good fruity, complex tiki drink is like a vacation in a glass. You know, like if you're stuck in your house and you can't go anywhere, it just for a moment, you can like feel and remember what it was like to be on the beach in Jamaica on our honeymoon with a nice painkiller or like, well, cause also I proposed to Courtney at a tiki bar, in Lono, Hollywood. It was a big thing. She was out visiting while I was out there. We were still long distance, but she was out to visit and I was like, well, babe, there's a big voiceover collective. One of the groups I'm a part of is having a meeting, kind of meetup group at Lono Hollywood. I'd love for you to meet some of the people. But, and little did she know that it wasn't actually a networking thing. It was just the proposal. So we went to the bar and kind of rented out the whole back room. And for like an hour, basically just pretended like it was a networking thing and meetup group and introduced her around to everybody. And then Jay Preston, I told him everybody knew what was going on, but I wanted to make sure that everybody that wanted to be there was there. And so then was like, hey, Jay, call some announcements and just make up some announcements. And so then he's like, all right, everybody, like, let's get together and talk about some of the upcoming stuff going on. And so he just bullshits a few announcements to sound like it's kind of the business portion of the meetup thing. And then he's like, and Michael, I think you've got some announcements too. And so then I was like, yeah. Well, so firstly, a lot of you guys have met my beautiful, girlfriend here and, she's out visiting right now. And then I just kind of ended up slowly segueing into talking about how much I loved her. And, and then I pulled out the ring. My mom is a jewelry designer. And so she made this just spectacular, like it looks like a fucking ring pop. It's just incredible. But yeah, so it's a what is it? Morganite is the stone. So much, much, much cheaper than a diamond, but just a huge, gorgeous, kind of rose pink stone. And so I pulled it out and then in the middle of the circle of all our actor friends and stuff, asked her to marry me. And so she was just totally surprised and blown away. And she thought that I was going to propose like a month later when we were going to be with my family in Phoenix. So she thought that that was when it was going to happen. So she was totally caught off guard. But anyway, so we had a bunch of tiki drinks. And so tiki cocktails kind of bring that experience back to me too. And Courtney surprised me with a really amazing tiki cocktail book by probably the foremost expert in tiki drinks, Martin Kate, and his bar, Smuggler's Cove. And it's just been fascinating. And so I've been kind of drinking my way through that book, trying to make as many of the drinks as I can. Well, so then when we moved out here, the house we bought had just this insane. I mean, ludicrous.
Yes.
Unjustifiably elaborate home bar. And I was like,
thank you, time.
Yeah, exactly. So I was like, well, I would be doing this home a disservice if this bar was unpopulated. So we had also, for interests of moving out here and making things easier, had been drinking through the stash during quarantine. And so we were down to between everything, whiskeys, rums, whatever, down to maybe 30 bottles of liquor. And so I went out and just, I blew a stupid amount of money. I think I've got like probably, I've had several shopping sprees since we moved, but I think I'm up to like 120 bottles of various.
Wow.
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah, of various things. And a lot of that's, you know, like Costco mixers or like stuff that's not expensive, but the nicer bottles are all up on the shelves and it just looks so nice. And we redecorated substantially and repainted and have tried to kind of recontextualize it as maybe not like a full out tiki bar, but like a really upscale bar. The whole house, we've tried to give it the vibes of like Puerto Los Cabos, like a nice all-inclusive tropical resort. Because if we're going to be stuck on quarantine forever with this idiot government, I might as well be stuck in quarantine on vacation.
Yep. And we will.
But the house was cheaper than my LA house. So I feel like I got away with something because like we've got double the house basically. And it's just so nice. And for way cheaper than our LA house for living expense wise. So why not put all that into booze? So anyway, I've gotten really into mixology and studying a lot of different like famous bartenders and YouTube channels and trying different things. And it just is a really fun way to get out of the house without actually getting out of the house and trying stuff that just transports you a little bit for a little while. So that's been the bar for me. And it's been a fun new hobby that I've gotten to invest myself into during the last 7 or 8 months.
I've got to connect you to Jen over at the Dork Web. She's a bartender in New York.
Sweet.
And she's a social media person and she loves to connect with people who's mixing drinks.
Awesome.
Kind of like you. So I'll be sure to connect you. That's awesome.
Yeah, that'd be fun.
Michael,
guess we're probably about wrapping up then, huh?
What? I mean, my gosh. Okay, let's kind of summarize here. for a kid from in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah,
with
it's
a passion
crazy
for music and performance, now signed with CESD and a voiceover CESD career.
It is pretty wild. I mean, as a lot of people that are kind of nose to the grindstone working on improving their craft have probably all experienced, it can be very surreal to when you look up and realize it's kind of like going on a hike, you know, when you turn around and there's a break in the trees and you're suddenly 10,000 feet above where you started. And it's like, oh, wow. Like, so that's, I've had that feeling a great deal. And I hope to keep that feeling and perspective of like, you know, even when things feel bleak, like literally tens of millions of people have heard my voice. And that is crazy.
Yeah.
It really is crazy. And that I've gotten even the friends of mine and colleagues that have had a lot of success or even ostensibly more success than me, you know, maybe they'll only be doing character work in video games. And so the thought that I, or only do commercial stuff. And so the thought that I've been able to have success with national commercial campaigns and major, I still can't talk about them, but enormous corporate jobs for like months on end doing corporate work or audiobook work or multiple AAA video games is just such a crazy, ridiculous blessing that I would have never even been able to believe if my 7 years ago self knew. So it's really humbling and very cool. And I just, every time I'm kind of finally starting to get some people that are like actually fans of me, which is very surreal and weird. And and signing my first like autograph or two, which is like, Wow. Why do you even? Okay. Well, I hope you don't think you're going to be able to sell this for anything. But but especially the Ori and the Will of the Wisps. Like, I have been blown away by the fandom and how lovely just all those people are in the Discord servers and the AMAs and streams and stuff are just so nice. And so, because, you know, for all intents and purposes, I didn't record that much for the games. Like, but even games like Slay the Spire that I maybe just did like, ha-ha, or like a little nonverbal something. And then people are like, oh, you're ho-ho for the merchant is my messenger notification. Like, that is, it's so cool. And being a lifelong gamer myself, like, that spent literally tens of thousands of hours on games. I had 11,000 hours in RuneScape.
Wow.
Yeah, don't tell that to anybody. You can edit that part out. But like, to be able to contribute in a substantive way to a form of media that was so formative for me growing up, you know, to think that some of the games and stuff that my brother and I played, our make-believe worlds in the forest with, are games that now I can, franchises that now I can be a part of, like, actually is just really, really cool. So grateful and thankful and blessed, as cheesy as that is. And we're always looking forward for the next cool thing that I can participate in and the next person that I can try to help along the way.
I mean, as cheesy as it may sound, I guess, but it's the truth, though, you know, the gratitude and the amount of respect that you have for this industry and the clients that you serve. It's quite admirable.
Well, that was even before I was doing character work. That was kind of my mindset was this, even if it's like a mom and pop business, like, they are trusting my voice to make their product or service or business sound more professional or to represent their goals to people in a way that they find is respectful and good. And so even the stuff that's not sexy, like doing corporate training for Firehouse Subs or something, like, they're trusting my voice to communicate their desires for the professionalism of their crew to, like, all their new hires. That's insane. You know, so people a lot of times get hung up on, you know, wanting to be a famous voice actor or have a bunch of Twitter followers and stuff. But, like, that doesn't really matter. I mean, it's another dopamine hit, right? But, like, you can get that fulfillment and that gratitude, if you really think about it, from even the stuff that's not sexy, like corporate training or whatever. It's still just as big of a vouching for your skills and what you can offer to this company, whether or not, you know, you're going to get a bunch of Comic-Con signings out of it.
Yes,
but that being said, I'm very interested in also getting Comic-Con signings. So, well, you know, why just do one thing?
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. Michael, I want you to know that this podcast is not about tips and tricks and advice for the beginning voice actors, but you in your position with your experience and where you are now. I think it's rather prudent for me to ask this question. If anyone out there who's listening, who are serious about their journey as a voice actor, can certainly jump on Google and search for things. But I'm interested in a piece of advice that you can offer that you cannot find on Google.
A piece of advice that you can't find on Google is that you are a global voice actor. You are a global talent because you have an internet. And that realization was what really lit a fire under my career. Was I was trying to reach out to a bunch of clients and studios in America, super competitive. Voice acting has only become more popular and more trendy over the last 7 years. You have an internet and there are people around the world that want to hire Western voice actors because they want Western consumers. So my first big client was I sent a cold email to a studio in Dubai and they just sight unseen, were like, hey, can you record a sample of this script? Okay, great. Do you want to do our YouTube series? And they ended up hiring me for 2 ads, 70 videos, and a TV pilot. Off a cold email, you know? So that's the, I guess, one big advice that was instrumental to my career that was told to me by a British actor named Guy Harris was, don't limit yourself or limit your scope of outreach. You know, you can get hired by people all over the world because they want what you offer. So, and there's a lot less competition because there's not as many Western voice actors over in the Philippines or Dubai or wherever it is. So, you know, go out and just be fearless. Also, another piece of advice is that most people are a lot easier to get in touch with than you might think. So if you ride the balance of being respectful and also being interested in a person as a person, not just what they can do for your career, you can get in touch with pretty much anybody that you really want to, if you have the balls to go try.
the mental balls, of course.
Yeah, mental balls, of course. testicular-esque fortitude. And then all the other advice you can't get on Google is in my extreme vocals class, which none of which is on Google. So,
which I'm severely and rather anticipatingly looking forward to this Saturday.
Yeah, I think it's going to be fun. And if a whole bunch of people listen to this and make me do another one, then so be it.
I certainly hope you open another one. What's next for Michael Schwalbe? What's next? I mean, you're already at this pinnacle that other voice actors are looking for. LA agent, successful voice career, full time, a loving Courtney, couple of dogs in Vegas. What's next for Michael Schwalbe?
Well, immediately next is dinner. I think my main goal right now is just getting back on top of my game and delivering stuff that I feel really, really good about instead of stuff that I'm just sending to send. So that's my immediate goal. I've got a number of really cool video games that are going to be coming out that I'm very excited about. And I would love to start. Another goal is just it sounds cheesy, but, and kind of self-indulgent, but building the, I don't want to say fan base, but like followers really do matter, especially in games and other character work things. And so, having more of a presence on social media will help me not only to promote if I do classes or things like that, but for some franchises that do want actors that are quote unquote known. And also it's just kind of fun. I'm stuck in my house. And so the more people I have to talk with on social media, the more fun I have just interacting with people and stuff. So I've been kind of investing in that. I'm getting my first few custom prints done for a few different games that I'm a part of that I think people might be interested in getting. And so I'm really looking forward to the next few months game-wise. I'm in 2 of the new PlayStation 5 exclusive releases. And that's really exciting. And I can't wait to tell people what those are. One of which was the biggest sessions that I've had yet.
Yes.
Seeing where that goes. And mostly just really trying to get back on the commercial game. Cause like characters are fun and it's fulfilling, but like they just don't pay nearly as well. And, it would be great to make a whole lot of money. So, some agency stuff that I've got in the works, probably can't talk about right now, but, got some new meetings that I'm looking to have and new connections that I'm looking to make. Another fun thing that I've been trying to, going back to like years ago when I would try to wiggle my way into social circles of other different actors, I've been putting together these digital happy hours for different actors that I hold in esteem and that have been going really well and having a lot of fun just catching up with and sometimes getting to know different actors that I haven't gotten to talk to in a long time. And then they bring friends that they want to have involved. And so then you make new acquaintances. And so just trying to stay in touch with actors of excellence and other people of excellence. And then just learning. I've been just super convicted about just the injustice in this country and being more politically minded and have been engaging and researching and donating to a lot of social organizations.
Yep.
And much more than in previous years. And also just being convicted by the thought of like, you know, the Jesus specifically said, contrasted the rich man giving a great deal of money to the church or whatever it was, the tabernacle, and then contrasting that with the widow that put in her two small coins and saying that truly she gave more. And so being challenged by that to like give in an amount that is sacrificial and not just an amount that like won't change my standard of living. Because I think that's really important too. This country is just full of fabulously wealthy and well-off people that even if they're donating what seems like a very substantial amount of money, it's not actually costing them anything.
Yeah.
And so I think that kind of goes against what giving should be. And sure, it's still better to give than to not give at all. But it goes back to the motive behind it. Like if we're just like, oh, well, here, take some, have a couple hundred dollars, go buy yourself something nice, you know, versus... you know, pulling money out of savings or out of your portfolio because a issue like COVID or the needs in the food banks have really gotten dire and saying, you know, I'm not just going to wait for other people to step up. I'm going to step up and I'm going to trust that God, who in his wisdom and provision provided all this money for me to begin with, will continue to give me the means to provide for myself, even if I give this amount of money that is going to make me feel really uncomfortable. So I've been trying to challenge myself in that regard. And just learn more about my faith and my Savior and the issues that a lot of people that aren't like me are dealing with. Because I have never, ever experienced a majority of the issues that a lot of people in this country have. And it's very convenient and easy to say like, well, I'm successful, so clearly my way is the right way. And the reason that they're not successful is because they're not doing what I'm doing. And rather than taking a step back and just listening and listening to the stories and the experiences and realizing that life is nothing like what my life is like for a tremendous amount of people. So as somebody that is a recovering pride addict and was really high on how great I thought I was 10 years ago, I think most of my goals, since by all accounts I've achieved and most of like career kind of goals is the real, you know, nobody's going to get to their grave and go like, man, I sure wish I worked harder. So I've been really spending a lot of time trying to focus on communication and listening skills and humility and acknowledging that the life that I've had is in no way, shape or form equitable to basically any like 99% of Americans' lives. And so it's so the hubris that it would take for me to say, well, my experience means that life is what I have perceived it to be. And you are wrong, even though you are saying you've experienced all these horrible things. You must have brought them on yourself. And because I'm one of very few raging, bleeding heart liberals in my either side of my family, I've been pretty much under constant attack for the last like 4 months by various family members for the convictions I have and beliefs that I have and the issues that I'm supporting. And so I'm also very involved in trying to educate them on why these things are valid and true and that we should listen to those that are oppressed and and try to be motivated less by how can I make as much money as possible and more of how can I elevate and treat other people like they're more important than I am. And that's really, really difficult for a variety of reasons. So I would say most of my goals moving forward are more social and personal and spiritual goals rather than like career motivated goals. Because if I continued to make the same amount of money that I'm making this year, cool. Like that's, I don't really need any more than that. But a lot of people do. So that's that, I'd say.
What a story, what a journey, and what a person you are. I say this because each and every one is so different and so unique and so fulfilling and so individualistic in their own right, in their decisions and in your philosophical, spiritual, political, religious, personal decisions. It's baffling.
Yeah, it's such a diverse, like people say voiceover or voice actor, and like every one of us's careers looks nothing like anybody else's, you know. So especially when you go through the path of what got us here, it's really pretty surreal.
Michael, if other people would like to investigate more into your extreme vocals class, as well as learn more about you as an actor, as a person, and as a voice actor, where could they go to find you?
Sure. So I don't have a lot about the class up anywhere. I'll send you a link so you can put it in if there's like a, I don't know, a text thing or a whatever. So I can send you that. Most of what I've been on lately is Twitter, which is at what he said VO is my Twitter handle. What he said VO. I have been getting more and more away from Facebook as it has become increasingly a tool for hatred and division. And also it's just not fun. Also, I hate that they artificially prevent your visibility unless you pay for the visibility. So that's mostly why I like Twitter, is because there's no walls that are preventing people from seeing you, unlike Facebook's algorithms. But anyway, so Twitter at what he said VO. Also, my website is where, if you want to listen to some demos or some past work stuff, is michael.schwal, schwal.b. michael.schwal.b. And that's my website.
Do you have to explain that every time you say that, I guess?
That might be the first time I've ever said it out loud. Usually I just, you know, usually, especially now that everybody's like quarantined, because the website only got finished like 5 months ago. And so we were already quarantined, I think. And so I pretty much am only copying, pasting it into emails and stuff where people are just like, oh my God, that's so clever. Which I'm really, it's another fortunate coincidence, because somebody has michaelschwalbe.com and they would not let me buy it from them, even though they're not using it. So I was like, fine, fuck you. I'll make my own website. And it'll be cleverer because it'll have a fancy little tag thing. What do you call it? Domain, whatever. Yeah, michaelschwal.b.
.b.
Good times. But yeah, Twitter is where I mostly talk to everybody. I'm way more addicted than I should be to it. Also, it gives me a lot of good news sources. I get all my headlines and stuff from there. But You gotta be careful, because you can very easily start doom scrolling and just think the whole world is ending. Yeah. Although I think it mostly is.
Depending on how this election comes out.
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much. Yeah, should I just ruin the whole podcast by saying, if you don't vote for Biden, American democracy will end, and this is not an exaggeration for a change?
Yeah, I'm going to agree. If any of you are listening who are not planning for, number one, voting, and number two, voting for Biden, you may turn this off and unsubscribe right now.
Well, don't do that. Instead,
do that right now.
DM me and tell me why you think I'm wrong, and I will be happy to give you, I will drown you in information, in reliable sources and research that is that will sway your opinion. I've spent way too much time on this year.
Belarus just had probably the biggest protest ever on their election results from just now.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's not an indication of what's to come, should the unthinkable come to fruition? Oh, boy.
Yeah. Yeah. But if I get on that, I'll talk for another 2 hours. So.
Michael Schwabe, thank you very much for your time and sharing your stories, your insight. It's been a pleasure. Absolute pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a lot of fun. And I look forward to talking to everybody that is listening to this. And I'm always accessible. Hit me up if you have any questions.
Perfect.
All right. Bye-bye.
This has been Voice Actor Showcase. Visit our website at voiceactorshowcase.com. If you'd like to be featured on this podcast, contact us at voiceactorshowcase.com. Thanks for listening.
Hello, my name is Eric Howell, and I'm the podcast editor for Voice Actors Showcase.
Whoa! Hey, get back! I'm trying to make a commercial here!
Anyways, if you have a podcast that needs editing, or you would like to make a voice acting demo reel, you can reach me at thepodcastdoctor@gmail.com. And I'll be with you right after I slay this dragon.
No, you! Come back here!